Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. In this part of Focus, we will be talking about third-party politics in America. And our guest for the program, someone who has made something of a specialty in reporting on third parties, his name is Micah Siffrey. He is former editor of The Nation, and currently senior analyst at Public Campaign. This is a nonpartisan campaign finance reform group. His work has appeared in a number of publications, including New York Times, The Nation, American Prospect, The Progressive, Salon, Wired, Mother Jones. He's the author of a book that looks at third-party politics in America that's titled Spoiling for a Fight. The book was first published in hardcover in 2002 and came out in paperback last year and makes interesting reading if you're into American politics and this subject in particular. We thought it'd be interesting to check in with him as we get into this year's presidential race, not only about what's happening with third parties on that level, but on other levels of American politics as well. Perhaps also we might have the opportunity to talk a little bit about campaign finance, since that's another interest of his. So in any case, questions are welcome. I know he would probably do his best to respond. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, if that's any easier, and it's probably not. 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Mr. Siffrey, hello.
Good morning, David. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Just fine.
Good. Well, thanks for being with us. Well, I tell you, I think acknowledging the fact that the media often doesn't pay enough attention to third parties at the, say, at the local level, what's happening off of the presidential election level, and also acknowledging that the criticism that people should pay attention to candidates other than Ralph Nader. Having said all that, let's talk about Ralph Nader to start, and then we'll get into some of these other areas as well. Just because he, at the moment, certainly as far as the national media is concerned, he's the guy that's getting a lot of attention. There's a lot of speculation about what his candidacy might mean for the Democrats on the presidential level. And then there's this issue of how it is that he may manage to get, or will he manage to get on the ballot, and where will he manage to get on the ballot? There has been this offer from the Reform Party to endorse him, and that would get him in the ballot in some states. But I guess maybe one of the questions one might ask is, why do you think that Ralph Nader, after having a fairly successful run last time around as a candidate of the Green Party, has decided to disassociate himself with the Greens?
Well, I think that he is determined that he could have more of an impact as an independent. I think there were both internal considerations related to what the Green Party is discussing about its whatever presidential candidate strategy it should have, and there were external considerations about, you know, what kind of voters he can reach. Internally, the Greens actually have a serious debate underway, which will presumably get resolved at the end of June when they have their convention in Milwaukee, over whether they should have a presidential candidate at all, and if that candidate, if they do nominate someone, if that candidate should run hard in all 50 states. They recognize that there is this perception from 2000 that Ralph Nader tilted the results in some key states, most notably Florida, and thus cost Al Gore the election. And I think there are many of the people within the Green Party who believe that if they contributed to George Bush getting reelected, that would hurt them very badly among the sorts of voters that they are trying to reach, who are mostly progressive or on the left. And Nader, while initially, you know, for the last 3 years, working to help build the Green Party, raising money for them, he never became a member of the party. He always had this kind of arm's-length relationship to its structures, and which has created some resentment beneath the surface as well among Greens. And when Nader heard that the party was not going to make its decision about a nominee until June, and that they were thinking about avoiding some of the battleground states, I think he took that as constraints that he simply didn't want. to accept. He, I believe, very strongly that you know, nobody owns anybody's vote. Everybody has to go out and earn their votes. You know, he completely rejects this notion of being a spoiler, that, you know, you can't spoil something that's already rotten. So he would not, he simply said, I will not, you know, wait for the Greens to make up their minds and not even seek their nomination formally, though he has said that he will accept their endorsement. The external reason, I think, is he believes that this time around he won't get many votes running, you know, focused on progressive voters, and instead he has a better chance reaching out to people in the angry middle, you know, people who voted for Ross Perot once upon a time, or who supported John McCain, or who have a more conservative slant and are just unhappy with the Bush administration. For everything from the war on Iraq to assaults on civil liberties, and that if you position yourself as an independent, you have a better way, you know, you can reach those people. I personally think that that's a bit of a dubious expectation for Nader. I don't think it's likely he's going to be able to pull that off, but that is what he's trying to do.
Hmm. Well, back in 2000, he was on the ballot in 43 states. Mm-hmm. Right now, he's not on the ballot any place. So maybe a big question is, just in how many places would people even have the opportunity to vote for him?
Yeah, he'll be on the ballot. I'm sure he'll be on the ballot in you know, somewhere close to 40, if not more, states than that. You know, the people who are experts in this, you know, the deadlines vary from place to place. Most of them haven't even come up yet, so it's not as if there's anything wrong with him not yet being on the ballot. The places so far where he has tried and stumbled include Texas, which has a very, very strict and difficult process for an independent to get on the ballot. Most of us would say that it's unfair. You know, you only have 60 days. You have to collect, you know, a huge number of signatures, something like 65,000, and they can only be from people who didn't vote in any of the party primaries. And, you know, I think election law experts will tell you that that's a standard that is too narrow and ought to be overturned on pure, you know, democracy grounds. So he may well end up getting on the ballot in Texas if his lawsuits succeed. You know, my guess is he will have no trouble getting on the first 30 states. Many states make it very easy. All you have to do is file with the Secretary of State or pay a small fee or, you know, hold a convention with 100 people. It's the last 10 where he may have some trouble because they really do, make it tough you know, the third parties often have a lot of trouble getting on the ballot in a couple of states where the petition requirements are very high. North Carolina, it's over 100,000, for example. And so in a few states, expect that he won't get on. But I think we should assume he will be on the ballot in you know, 40 or more states come November.
Hmm. You wrote a piece for the Washington Post, and I opened the subject at the risk of knowing that we might get a bunch of people wanting to call in just endorsing Ralph Nader. Mm. But you wrote a piece for the Post acknowledging the fact that you in the past had supported Nader and mm-hmm. admired him and what it is that he's managed to do in so many areas, mm-hmm. but saying that you personally thought that there wasn't – his candidacy this time around didn't make a whole lot of sense.
Yeah.
You said that, and also you said that maybe Mr. Nader himself doesn't really think that he's going to be elected president, but somehow thinks that by advocating for and talking about certain issues, that what he can do is get the Democratic Party to pick up on those issues, and he seems to think that what he can do is nudge the party perhaps a little bit more in his direction.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I wonder whether you think that that's likely.
Well, you know. I mean, given the actual issues that have come up and the kind of campaign that John Kerry is running, you know, Nader is repositioning himself now as the peace candidate, you know, with just sort of a very simple let's get out of Iraq position, which is in a way easy to do, given that he won't ever have to actually, you know, implement it. He won't be in the position of having to have a full-fledged plan to do it. And, you know, this is, you know, a role that third-party candidates do play in American history, which is that they force some neglected issue that is actually, you know, supported by a substantial number of people, but that the major parties are not talking about. And if you look at the polls, you know, there's something like 20 to 30% of the public who thinks we should just get out of Iraq. And yet both major party candidates right now are, you know, Bush and Kerry are in favor of staying there until the job is done, whatever that means, and however costly that may be. And so it is not unwise for Nader to try and do this, and I think it is a challenge to Kerry in particular to come up with a response that, that can win the, you know, couple of percent of the voters who are right now saying that they favor Nader, and I suspect a lot of them it's for that very reason. The reason why I wrote in the Washington Post that I don't think this, the Nader candidacy makes sense is I think for progressives, I was speaking to people who, you know, want positive social change in this country, there is a recognition right now that the Bush presidency is so dangerous, so far out of the mainstream, so unlike what Bush campaigned as when he claimed to be a compassionate conservative who would have a humble approach to world affairs and you know, instead of this sort of cowboy unilateralist that we've seen, that there is so much at stake in this election that it isn't a time to worry about remodeling the House. We just have to put out the fire. And you know, that the Nader message may have a lot of valid points, but that doesn't compel turning it into a candidacy. My dog has decided...
Does the dog want to go out? Is he for Nader? Is that what this is about?
The dog does not have a position, but if you'll forgive me for 30 seconds, I will put her away.
Absolutely. Well, it will give me an opportunity to introduce our guest for this part of Focus 580.
We'll be right back.
We're talking with Micah Sifry. He is a former editor of The Nation and is also senior analyst at Public Campaign. This is a campaign finance reform group. He's written for many different publications in addition to The Nation, and as I said at the beginning, has made something of a specialty of reporting on third-party politics in the United States. He's the author of a book on this subject, which was first published in 2002 in hardcover and then came out in paperback last year and remains interesting reading if you are into this subject and curious about the Reform Party and the Libertarians and the Greens. His book is titled Spoiling for a Fight, Third-Party Politics in America. Routledge is the publisher, and as I said, it is available now in paperback, so you can head out to the bookstore, or certainly you could find it in the library. We're talking this morning about third-party politics in the United States, and would certainly welcome anybody who is interested in calling in here and making comments, asking questions. We have a caller who is ready to go, and we'll get right to them in just a little bit. Here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call in, the number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Are you there, Micah?
Yeah, I'm here.
All right. We have a caller in Chicago. Let's talk with them. This is our line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Yes. You're going to have to forgive me, but I think your position doesn't make much sense, and I'm talking to you as a general and for all the progressives, because it seems to me that it's easy to attack Nader because you're avoiding the two real problems of why Bush was elected and will probably be elected again. The first problem was simply the cheating that went on in Florida, and subsequent inquiries proved that in many other states there is election fraud. And Greg Palast documented that in his book, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. Instead of focusing on that, which would probably be taking on big guns and maybe contributors to progressive causes, it's easier to focus on Nader. The second problem is that less than half of the population that's eligible to vote because they are always have this choice, which Jay Leno aptly said, is choosing between a rich white guy from Yale and a rich white guy from Yale. People simply are not going to turn up at the polls. And unless we really deal with bringing more people to the voting places in the first place, which I think having a third-party candidate does, we will still get Bush. As you said, Kerry, unfortunately, seems to only want to do what Bush does, but he says he can do it better. And because a lot of people don't want what Bush wants, Kerry isn't getting any traction, even as Bush goes down the tubes. So I feel very angry at people who are supposedly progressives who focus on Nader and don't focus on the real issues, which is people who can vote don't vote, and people who do vote often get their votes stolen.
Well, in my defense, let me say that I was answering a question about Nader. I am not spending much of my time running around whining about Nader. I am not supporting any of the organizations that are focusing their attention on attacking Nader. I think it's wrong for Nader. As if you were listening, I was saying that the ballot restrictions keeping Nader off the ballot in places like Texas were undemocratic. I think he has every right to run. I just think that the progressives do face a hard choice in this election. It is nowhere near as clear a equation as you could have done in 2000 when Al Gore and George Bush were both running to the middle and agreeing on just about everything except perhaps the issue of abortion and the issue of gun control. This time around, I would disagree with you. I would say that while Kerry is, yes, in the same foreign policy mold as Bush, he is not a unilateralist. He is not a man who believes in making preemptive war. And I think that if he got elected, there would be some breathing room and some chance to organize for positive change. And that's one of the issues that the issues you raise about election fraud and non-voters, how to motivate them. Those are long-term problems that we have to attack. But we also have an election in November. We're not going to solve those problems overnight, are we?
No, but we had 4 years between 2000, and I haven't seen any of these same progressives raising the issue during the past 4 years. And I think
your complaint is with them, not with me, ma'am. I work on campaign finance reform every day to open up the political system.
This is not an attack against you personally. I'm talking about progressives in general, and that's when I said my first statement. I said that you is a general you.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sorry to say we're beyond breathing room if you look at the problems in this country. And even if Kerry wants to do these policies multilaterally, the policies are wrong, and they're what have gotten us in the fix that we're in. And people
who just want a breathing space
are in trouble because I think we're beyond breathing space.
You know,
we
David,
need real change.
This is a good call because it does show there are people who strongly feel that the two-party system is broken beyond repair. And I believe that many of these people would not be voting for Kerry or Bush in the first place. There is a hardcore, it may be a couple million people, who, and that number may well be growing, we don't know, who are attracted to third parties. I mean, let's not forget, Ross Perot got 20 million votes in 1992. 4 years later, he got 8 million votes, even though people knew he was not a serious candidate at that time. There are a lot of people who have said the heck with these two parties and who believe that the only way to move forward is to go outside that box.
Let me just I want to give the caller a chance for a follow-up, but I also do want to invite other people who are listening. If you have comments, come on into the conversation. Was there anything, ma'am, you wanted to add? Okay. Well, others are certainly welcome to join the conversation. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Again, our guest is Mike Asifri. He's former editor of The Nation. He's now senior analyst at Public Campaign, which is a campaign finance reform group, and has done a lot of writing about third-party politics in America. I'm interested in maybe having you talk a little bit about what's happening now with the Reform Party. You mentioned just a moment ago that indeed Ross Perot in 92 got 20 million votes running for president of the Reform Party, and then not as successful in 96, but still a significant number, 8 million. And of course, people maybe are aware of the fact that it seems that ever since that time, the Reform Party there's been a lot of conflict and some splintering of the party. And right now, as I mentioned, there has been this offer by the Reform Party to endorse Ralph Nader. What's happening with the Reform Party?
Well, in 2000, there was the party basically fell apart. There was one wing that was inspired by Jesse Ventura's victory in Minnesota, you know, independent governor there who came out of a party that had had its roots in the Perot movement, even though it was called the Independence Party. That wing of the party was basically purged at the beginning of 2000, and then the other two parts fought over the remnants. There was an old sort of Perot wing that was hoping they could bring back Ross, and a new Pat Buchanan wing that basically came in when Buchanan decided to leave the Republican Party and seek the Reform Party's nomination. And they fought to a draw and then to a split. And Buchanan ended up winning the larger part, and he got you know, this pile of public funds that were the due of the party for Perot having gotten 8 million votes 4 years earlier. And then, you know, he got ill. His campaign didn't go very well. He got a few hundred thousand votes and essentially dropped out of politics. He's now editing a conservative magazine. And the shards of the Reform Party that are left are really, in my view, dying embers. They have ballot status in seven states, and they have no money. They have no real membership. The thing that was painfully laughable about the announcement that they were endorsing Ralph Nader was that they claimed 1 million active members. And believe me, if they had 1 million active members, you and I would know it. At best, maybe they have a few hundred active members. But they still retain these ballot lines, you know, that could be a saving of some money for Nader should he decide to take those lines. In addition, because the media does such a poor job of following third parties, he's getting the sort of free effect of this Reform Party label being attached to him, which perhaps has some value and resonance for some people who don't know the facts about the actual you know, standing and strength of the party. And you know, that so that may help him as he tries to create the image that he once had. By the way, you know, Ralph Nader, I think, could have been the Ross Perot of 1992. I actually spent time, this is when I first really started covering him, traveling around New Hampshire with him in the fall of 1991. There were a group of his associates who were all hoping to draft him to run for president as an independent, and they created a campaign structure up there, and he was having huge rallies, but he was refusing to be a candidate. He said, "I will be a stand-in for none of the above. Write in my name if you support none of the above." And he had a platform that was nonpartisan. It was mostly about political reform and reform of corporate power. There wasn't the same ideological content that came with becoming a candidate of the Green Party. And you could tell from the people who came to Nader's rallies back then that he really did have an appeal across the political spectrum. And at the end of the day, he got 2% of the vote, not only in the Democratic primary, but got 2% of the vote in the Republican primary back in 1992. But he decided not to be a candidate then, and then his trajectory took him towards the Green Party, and ultimately, you know, he now has told us his positions on a whole array of issues that appeal to people on the left, but were never part of Ralph Nader's original consumerist, environmentalist, you know, defender of the little guy persona. And for him now, I think he's trying to go back to that, but at the same time, he's also got some very left-wing positions, and I think it's pretty dissonant. I don't know how you convince, you know, a conservative or independent voter who may be unhappy with Bush on some issues like the war or the Patriot Act to support Nader on those things and ignore the fact that Nader also wants to raise their taxes, you know, regulate their businesses far more than they are regulated now, you know, shrink the size of the military, which is an institution that lots of conservatives are fans of, and yet he thinks he's going to be able to get votes from these people.
We have some other callers here. Let's talk with someone locally in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I would say this to my fellow progressives, that there are two issues with comparing Kerry and Bush. The stated positions may be very similar, but the unstated Bush agenda is not a neo progressive or neoliberal, it's neoconservative. And I think there is very little evidence that Kerry would stay on indefinitely in Iraq, while it appears that Bush really does want to set up an empire. He's still building 14 military installations, permanent installations in Iraq. The other point is, someone is going to probably nominate two members to the Supreme Court in the next 4 years, and two more neoconservatives would position the real center of power in the Supreme Court, not the presidency or the Congress. And this would probably enshrine neoconservatism indefinitely in this country. And I think that progressives should give this very careful consideration in considering whether they want to waste a vote. Thank you.
All right. Well, you want to comment on that, Mr. Sipper?
No, I think that the caller spoke pretty eloquently. I don't disagree with his analysis of the stakes of this election. I personally don't like the phrase waste your vote. I don't believe the only wasted vote is one that isn't cast. So it's the people who stay home who are wasting their votes. Anybody who casts a vote, even if you vote for someone who has no chance of winning, is still expressing a preference, and that's your right in a democracy.
All right, let's go to someone in Indiana, line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, well, the caller from Champaign took away my sale, and his answer took away the other sale, so I'll just step and say I'm progressive. Very difficult being one in Indiana because there's very few people that you can actually vote for who are along those lines, and when there are those people, they're Democrats, and that's the reason why Kerry's got my vote.
Hmm. All right.
Thank you.
Can I just say something about this problem of people who live in states or districts that are, obviously tilt one way or another, in terms of their partisan coloration? That is a ongoing problem in America. We have this winner-take-all system where, you get all the representation for just getting the majority of votes, or in some cases just a plurality of votes. And anybody who's a minority, whether, political minority or ethnic, whatever it is, they get nothing. They get no representation. And this is really archaic. It's high time that we looked at ways of giving political minorities some representation so that there actually is more buy-in. So somebody who lives in Indiana who's a Democrat doesn't have to feel like they're completely voiceless. That said, I also think that in the age of the Internet, something new is happening, because now there are all sorts of interesting new efforts underway for people who live in states that are tilted one way to try and affect politics in the rest of the country nonetheless. You can band together now much more easily, and this is true for anybody, not just Democrats in Indiana, but Republicans in Illinois or wherever. You can find other like-minded people and band together for common action that crosses state boundaries, that goes up to Washington and then goes back locally in many new ways that are I guess we always had the power before, but it wasn't as easy to do. And there is something about, for example, the organization Move On, just a few weeks ago, sent out an email to its 2 million members inviting them to go to people's homes on a weekend with their cell phones, when you have free airtime on your cell phone, and get a list of phone numbers to call in swing states. So even if you didn't live in a swing state, you could call undecided voters in a swing state and try and reach people with, obviously, in their case, a pro-Kerry message. And from what I hear, they've pulled off about 300,000 phone calls in just one day. And this is, well before the election, when I'm sure they're going to do it in a more systematic way. So this problem of unequal representation and inadequate representation, a lot of people feel it, and there's a need to do something about it. And either the political system is going to react by changing this winner-take-all rule to some form of proportional representation, or people are going to use things like the Internet to create new tools for empowering themselves. and they'll feel represented that way.
Well, was the caller still there? Want to add anything?
I buy all of that, but unfortunately, the election's very soon, and it would take quote-unquote, an act of God to get all this together, and since you're across state lines, you're running a lot of problems. My main concern is that Supreme Court. Now, I agree wholeheartedly with the fellow from Champaign that it wouldn't make much difference who in the hell was in power. If we get a 7-2 grouping, it's really going to be bad for, we may not even be around as progressives. They may put something through to get rid of us. That's what my ultimate concern is. First time I ever had this true concern in an election. I'm in my 60s now, and that just frightens the daylights out of me. I read a lot of literature about the things going on with Bush's lieutenants, and a lot of that even doesn't make the newspapers or even even doesn't make it on the internet as far as that goes. You have to listen to all these talk shows and BBC and shortwave and all kinds of stuff. There's an incredible thing going on here, and if we don't get it stopped, we may not even be talking on this phone to a public news, public radio, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, God forbid.
Thanks a lot. Right, yeah.
Thanks for the call.
I'm some ways I'm glad I'm the age I am. Okay, well, right. Keep up the good work.
Well, just if we're talking about changing things that now exist, people don't want to change the way the things are now. Whether you're either talking about ballot access, you're talking about proportional representation, anything like that, those folks are going to come up against the significant challenge posed by the major parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, mm-hmm. where the rules are written to favor them and to make it more difficult for third parties to challenge. And it doesn't seem terribly likely that the Democrats and the Republicans would make a change if it looked like it was going to threaten their hold on the system.
Well, this is the argument you could use against any form of social change, which is the people who are in power don't like to give up power. And I agree, it's difficult, but that's again, we do have the right to assemble and demand that our grievances be heard, that is how change does happen in America. I mean, women didn't have the right to vote, and men didn't have to give it to them. Blacks didn't have the right to vote. They didn't, they weren't even considered full human beings in the Constitution. You can think of a lot of injustices that have been addressed and that have expanded, the franchise and the meaning of democracy. And I think that, again, there is a history in America, by the way. It's not like we've only had winner-take-all elections everywhere. In Illinois, I think there actually is an old history of a form of proportional representation in the elections to the state legislature, and there's some people who are trying to bring that back. In San Francisco, they recently passed an initiative that would allow for instant runoff voting, which is essentially a form of ranked voting where you if there are more than two candidates on the ballot, you can pick your first choice, your second choice, and so on. And if your first choice doesn't win and has the fewest votes, then your vote gets reassigned to your second choice. And that's a way to get around the so-called spoiler problem. And, I think that as people complain about these obvious flaws in the system, and they find, again, as they find ways to band together to demand change, that change will happen. I think the other is that the Democrats and the Republicans are both threatened by this. And in some cases, there's all this talk about Nader, potentially hurting Kerry, and there's very little talk about the fact that there are two other third parties, the Libertarians and a religious fundamentalist party called the Constitution Party, that are also going to have presidential candidates this year. And those candidates could very well, even though they're not going to get a lot of votes, they could very well get enough of the margin to cost George Bush in a few states. If this happens to Republicans and Democrats at the same time, they may both decide that it's in their interest to figure out how to give third parties a way of contesting races without being spoilers.
Yeah. Well, you make a good point, and I think that other people have pointed to that too, as well as that the media will pay a lot of attention to Nader and the question of will Nader pull votes from Kerry. But at the same time, there is this other question that doesn't get as much attention, and that is, would conservative alternatives to the Republican Party pull votes from George Bush? Mm-hmm. And the one thing you have to say is that even while it's certainly true, as you have said, that ballot access rules make it difficult for third parties to get on the ballot, it is possible, and the Libertarian Party in 2000 had their presidential candidate on the ballot in every state.
Right.
And in fact, the Libertarians, I think, just this weekend are going to have their convention.
That's right.
Can you want to talk a little bit about the Libertarians? And then I promise we have some callers here.
Sure.
Well, the
Libertarians, you know, are actually, a fairly strong third party. And it's mainly because they have two things. One is that they have a pretty clear ideology, in terms of opposing government in almost all its forms and seeing the seat of power in the individual, and they have money. They have some wealthy supporters, and that has enabled them to build a sophisticated national party structure, and they've got chapters in just about every state, and they're very, very good at getting themselves on the ballot and getting candidates to run for office. Their problem has been that they're too doctrinaire, that, in fact, most Americans have a little small L libertarian in them. You know, we don't really want government prying into our homes or our bedrooms or telling us how to live. The attitude of live and let live is, I think, very strong. But for libertarians, people who are attracted, and this is true for third parties, I found when I was writing Spoiling for a Fight, it's one of the difficulties that third parties have, is that they attract the true believers. And people who are a little bit more willing to compromise and work within the system and, you know, want to try and achieve something, even if it isn't everything that they want, gravitate towards the two major parties. But true believers aren't as concerned necessarily with winning power as they are with expressing their beliefs. And so you get, in the libertarians especially, a very strong doctrinaire thread that has made it hard for them, I think, to get more than 1% of the vote in most of the races where they put up candidates. Again, if it's a very tight election, that can be enough to tip the balance. The one interesting exception happened just recently in Wisconsin with Ed Thompson, the brother of the former governor, Tommy Thompson, who ran and got, I think, about 10% of the vote in running for governor. And he ran as a Libertarian Party candidate. But he was a bit more of a happy-go-lucky guy, a bar owner. You didn't get that same feeling of ideological intensity off of him. And I think that is, the libertarians would be smart if they could follow a bit more in his footsteps and not be as purist. What will happen out of their convention next weekend? They have two candidates seeking their nomination. One of them is a Hollywood producer named Aaron Russo, and the other one is a talk radio, syndicated talk radio host named Gary Nolan. If I had to guess, I think Russo has a little bit more of the Ed Thompson in him and may well be able to spread the party's message a little bit further. He's got Jack Nicholson support from the past when he ran for governor of Nevada and got about 26% of the vote in a Republican primary a couple of years ago. So the guy has some vote-getting ability. Nolan, I think, as a talk radio host, may well have a broad audience but a thin base of support wherever he goes. It's really too soon to say, but I do think that we should be paying attention to what the libertarians could do to Bush. I think there's a lot of conservatives who are worried about entrenchment, on individual civil liberties, and there's some, over the top conspiracy thinking out there as well. But hey, those people can come out and vote too. So they could well be the real wild card in this election instead of Nader.
We have about 15 minutes left in this part of the show. Our guest is Micah Siffrey. As a journalist, he spent a lot of time following and writing about third-party politics in America. He has a book on this subject. It's titled Spoiling for a Fight. That's available now in a paperback edition. Routledge is the publisher. He is former editor of The Nation and is now senior analyst at Public Campaign. That's a campaign finance reform group. 333-9455 for Champaign Urbana, toll free 800-222-9455 if you'd like to call in. Here's a caller in Sydney to talk with, line number 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I would like to say that I'm a fan of Ralph Nader, and I like the Green Party, but I'm going to be voting for John Kerry because I understand how important this national election is. What I'd like to see is the Green Party really be a grassroots party and run for local offices, state representatives, town governments, get their foot in the door, get some voting records so the public can see what they're about, and then run national campaigns. And I'm going to hang up and listen to what you have to say about that.
All right. Well, that I think that gets at the kind of strategy that I think probably a lot of people would say that's got to be the way for third parties to go, that I don't think very many people expect that they're going to break through at the presidential level. But what they've got to do is get people elected to county boards and city councils and state legislatures and build their base that way before they could be thinking about electing people to the presidency,
sure,
or maybe even to the Senate. Although there again, there, you know, if you build up your organization from the ground, that's something that you might think about.
Yeah, well, I've always said that that's actually the area of greatest opportunity for third parties is in local elections. A lot of them are uncontested. In many cases, what we really ought to be saying is this is a second party because you've got cities that are dominated by Democratic machines where you don't even see competitive races. You see this in a lot of places. And indeed, the Greens and to some extent the Libertarians, too, have had their greatest success at local-level elections. In fact, in San Francisco this fall, the Greens almost elected the mayor. Their candidate, who was president of the Board of Supervisors out there, got 47% of the vote. So there's definitely more opportunity, and the barriers to entry are lower. And you do get a chance to show, hey, you know, we're not crazy people. We actually have an alternative vision for how to govern, and then we can deliver better services and more sensible policies, and voters will begin to trust you. The problem is that it's hard. There's less gratification to somebody who really wants to express their beliefs and pound their chest and feel good about, voicing a protest in getting elected to the school board or the municipal water board or whatever it may be. And again, that true believer problem is there. You know, the people do gravitate towards the one big race that gets the most, they get everybody talking about, even, you know, whereas most of us probably can't even name our own local congressman. But I think the caller is right, and, when I did a piece this fall for The Nation magazine about the debate within the Green Party over what to do in this election, it was very interesting that a lot of their elected officials, people who are on city councils in places like Hartford, Connecticut, or out in Colorado, told me, we don't think this is the wrong way to go about it. We got to build from the bottom up, not from the top down. Nader did us a favor in 2000 by running and attracting a lot of new people into the party, and it helped them found new chapters around the country, but that the important work was at the local level, and that, if anything, a presidential race draws energy away from that work. And in this context, given the stakes of Bush, re-electing Bush for four more years, would actually hurt their local organizing efforts. And so I've been saying to people, I actually think this is a fateful year for the Green Party. They may well make a choice that relegates them to obscurity, that where they'll continue to noodle along but never really make further headway, because if people blame them for the re-election of Bush and they are trying to get the votes of progressives in local races, they will just have a much harder time doing it after this race.
Mm-hmm. We have a couple of callers here. They're both on cell phones, so we'll go in the order they came. We'll take first line number 4 right here. Hello.
Hi. I'd like to respectfully disagree with your guest with his diagnosis of the problem with the Libertarian Party. From my point of view, well, they are doctrinaire. I also, from my perspective, view the Greens as doctrinaire as the Libertarians, just different. And I was wondering if he had a secondary diagnosis why the Libertarians have been losing votes steadily since 1980.
Well, my secondary diagnosis is, I'll grant you that, from the perspective of someone on the right-hand side of the spectrum, the Greens probably do look doctrinaire, too. Let's be fair about it. But here's the other thing. As far as I know, up till recently, there is no reason to live anywhere in specific as a libertarian. There's no geographic concentration of libertarians of any note compared to the Greens, who in fact do cluster and come out of places that tend to be countercultural enclaves, university towns, you know, places like Santa Fe, you know, that are lifestyle refuges for people, and thus, you know, they have a base. There is this project that has some roots in the libertarian movement called the Free State Project, which is the idea is to convince a lot of people to all move to one state and then try and tip the balance of state politics in a more libertarian direction. And I believe that about 20,000 people have participated in this, and they all debated for a while and ultimately decided that New Hampshire was the place to go, which already New Hampshire, you know, has some strong libertarian leanings, and they've in fact even elected over a couple of years back some people to their state legislature from the Libertarian Party. So if libertarians figure out how to cluster geographically, then in a system that rewards concentrations of votes by geography, they may well have some more success.
Well, I hope that gets the question of the caller. Let's go to another caller, also somebody here, I think, on cell phone, line number two. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I want to make a comment, but first I guess I should make another comment. As a person who's voted for the Libertarian Party since 1972, the Libertarian Party, I really don't like the phrase that they're doctrinaire. I guess what you mean is that they have a belief system that's consistent, and they try to fit all policies into that belief system. And doctrinaire is a very sort of...
Well, maybe I should have used the word too purist. I'll give you an example. When Jesse Ventura...
You're right about that.
When Jesse Ventura got elected governor in 1998, he actually went around. When people would ask him what his philosophy was, he'd say libertarian. And he had taken the party's... they have this little political test to figure out where you stand ideologically, and discovered that he actually fit as a libertarian. But as governor, he also said, you know, that there was a role for government in providing things like public schools and vaccinations for children. And when the libertarians actually had a conference in Minnesota that he spoke at, and people were heckling him. And after that, he said, the heck with this party, and he tore up his ID card. And that's what I mean by being too doctrinaire.
I understand that. I want to get to my comment, but I will tell you this, that there is a, if there's a geographical area where libertarians are important, it happens to be in Alaska. And you can see that in some of their older policies when they were legalizing marijuana. But the real point I wanted to make is I think one of the biggest problems we've had with third parties in this country, and this goes back to the Dixiecrats, it goes back to George Wallace, it goes back to Ralph Nader, is that these are parties of the disaffected, the disinherited, the people who don't like what's going on. I hang out with a group of guys at the coffee shop every morning, and we're liberals and conservative and libertarians and socialists. And the amazing thing to me is that every single one of us said that we would vote for McCain if he would run any way he wants as a third party. And these are people who actually just have incredible respect for him.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if something like that could happen, if McCain could even be persuaded to run as an independent, then you would actually see third party quite likely. I don't know what would happen, but it would really be interesting.
Oh, sure. I don't disagree with you. I actually think that the best opportunity for a third-party candidate is to run up the middle and to try and portray both of the major parties as out of touch, as beholden to their big money donors and to their special interest, you know, little interest groups. And that's, in fact, how Jesse Ventura won. He didn't run from the left or from the right. He ran up the middle. And, you know, McCain might be a candidate who could do that. I suspect there's a little bit of a political Rorschach test going on here, in that a lot of people, I think, project onto McCain what they want to see and ignore the things that they don't want to see about him. In many ways, he's actually quite conservative. But he has a refreshing honesty.
That's the point.
And that's what makes him compelling.
That's right. Not that he's up the middle, but that he's an honest person and he says what he believes.
Right.
Support him even when they disagree with his position, because they know that it comes from something he really believes, as opposed to Democrats and Republicans.
Yes, I actually think the public is hungry for people who know what their beliefs are. I think that's the same reason why Paul Wellstone was successful, even though his views were definitely much to the left of you know, the middle in Minnesota. But people there said they liked that the guy fought for what he believed in, that he didn't mince words, and that he had a strong set of core beliefs that obviously also resonated with a lot of people. And I think we would be in a much healthier place in this country if we could have more politicians like that.
We're going to have to stop. My apologies. We have one person here that we just can't take because we're here at the end of the time. For people who are interested in reading more about the subject of third-party politics in America, you can look for the book that we mentioned. It's now out in paper. It's titled Spoiling for a Fight. It's published by Routledge. And also, if you're interested in the subject of campaign finance reform, you can go and you have internet access. You can go to the website of Public Campaign, the group that Mr. Siffrey is associated with, and that's www.publiccampaign.org, and you can see what they are up to. Our guest, Mike Siffrey, is a senior analyst at Public Campaign, former editor of The Nation. And Mr. Siffrey, thanks very much.
My pleasure. Anytime.